Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The House delays a vote on Speaker Boehner's debt bill, despite the Speaker's arm-twisting to move ahead.
For the sake of our country, I'm asking the representatives in the House in a bipartisan way and asking my colleagues in the Senate, let's pass this bill and end this crisis.
But freshman GOP Representative Joe Walsh won't cry uncle until the Tea Party sees a bill they like, deadline or no deadline.
Default isn't even on the table. Let's make sure we get this right. And if that means going to August 3rd or August 6th, let's do a real solution.
And America looks on, mostly aghast. Here's Reverend C. Welton Gatty, president of the Interfaith Alliance, addressing a rally on Capitol Hill.
It is time for people of faith and goodwill to speak up, and it is time for some politicians in Washington to grow up.
This hour on Point, a special weekly news roundtable on the debt ceiling standoff that threatens to become a meltdown, with Ben Smith of Politico, Margaret Taleb of Bloomberg, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Do you think we'll see a deal before the deadline? And what happens if we don't? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And later this hour, we're expecting to hear from the president on the state of the negotiations. First, joining us from New York is Ben Smith, senior political writer for Politico. Ben Smith, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us from Washington is Margaret Taleb, White House correspondent for Bloomberg. Margaret Taleb, welcome back to you, too.
Thank you, Jackie, and hi, Ben.
Margaret.
And hello there, Jack.
Hi, Jackie, Ben, and Margaret.
Well, we are here at, I would say, a historic time together. And why don't we start with you, Margaret, because you're in Washington and you're the White House correspondent. What do you think the president is going to say?
The president most likely will continue the message that he's been sort of massaging since Friday, which is somewhere between lawmakers get this done and American people tell lawmakers to get this done, and trying to walk a careful line between calling out Republicans and calling out all of Congress at the same time. But the urgency is, you know, obviously stepped up the closer we get to the August 2nd deadline.
Well, and we will, as I said, break away a little bit for the president when he speaks, which we expect to happen. It could be as soon as 10 minutes from now. So either of you, Ben or Jack, how did we get here? Maybe we need to just step back for a moment while we wait and talk about last night when we expected that the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, would call a vote on his proposal. And despite a day of everything from, you know, pizza and arm twisting and clips from the Town movie with Ben Affleck, he didn't get the votes he needed, did he, Ben?
No, I mean, I think, you know, his strength in these negotiations all along has been to say, look, I got this rabid dog. I can't control my dog. You know, so you've got to make way for me because I'm just barely going to be able to bring my caucus along. And in a way, his weakness all along has been his strength. And that sort of collapsed last night when it turned out that even when he got what he had basically, you know, when he sort of reached the goalpost that he had set for himself, he just wasn't able to bring, you know, about 25 conservatives in his caucus to vote for it.
Did that surprise you, Jack?
No, it really didn't. The discourse on the right has just simply been so radical, I guess is the only way to put it. I mean, they have simply, Michelle Bachmann typifies it. She says, we don't need to raise the debt ceiling. Another congressman of that group, Paul Bruhn of Georgia, he said, we need to lower the debt ceiling. These people aren't acknowledging reality, and their corporate funders haven't got the message to them, or the populistic, sort of almost know-nothing wing of the GOP just isn't listening to them.
Earlier today, as the Dow declined somewhat, over 1%, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said that the economy should not be held hostage to extremists. Margaret, do you think that the that the rhetoric is going to, I'm not necessarily mean more shrill, perhaps more acute. I mean, it really seems to be words like hostage, ransom, that kind of thing. I don't think we heard that as much earlier in the week.
I think that what we've seen so far is lawmakers trying to gauge how far out they got with the rhetoric because they don't want to be what gets the markets going. And at the same time, a sense that within this core of the House Republican caucus, it's possible that the markets will be the only thing that can prod a reaction. I mean, and it's a tricky calculus, right? Because it's one thing to have a showdown over an ideological issue that will come back, you know, to resurface in an election campaign. And it's another thing to have a showdown with treasuries and the stock market. And so it's not entirely clear yet how far the president's willing to go with his rhetoric. He's been very careful so far and how willing lawmakers are. But as you see the markets begin to react on their own, I think, you know, it appears to me that it's going to be a combination of that and also of the time clock that is going to decide Speaker Boehner's next step with or without his whole caucus.
Jack, before we take calls, and we really want to take your calls today, could you give us a little historical perspective here? I mean, where is John Boehner and this Congress relative to legendary speakers of the House, Tip O'Neill or Sam Rayburn? What's going
well,
on?
Well, one difference is the Republicans, to their credit, many people think, have forsworn earmarks. They don't deal in that anymore. So Speaker Boehner can't say to somebody a version of what Lyndon Johnson said to Frank Church, the senator from Idaho. Church made a speech in which he quoted Walter Lippmann criticizing the president on the Vietnam War. And when Johnson saw Church at a party, he said, "Frank, the next time you need a dam in Idaho, ask Walter Lippmann." You can't do that. The president can't do it. The speaker doesn't have that kind of arm-twisting ability anymore. And so he's a much less powerful figure than almost any speaker before him, I think because of what's happened with, you know, really what was a reform on earmarks.
And how are these freshman Congress people being rated in terms of their conservative stripes? There's a class of, I believe, help me out here, Margaret, about 80 freshman congressmen?
Yeah, closer to 90. Yeah, absolutely. So 87. So, I mean, it really varies district to district. You're seeing a case in Ohio now where one of the holdouts on this may be facing the threat of congressional redistricting as a result of this. And so
that's Jim Jordan.
That's right, and this is a big test case now. Between now and the 2012 re-election, you know, many of these clamp down on spending lawmakers, and they feel like that's their mission. That's why they came to Washington. That's what they were elected to do. Their position right now is they answer to voters in their district, not to the House Speaker, and that's an unusual dynamic.
Jack?
Yes, well, there's something called Denominate. It's a computer program devised by a consortium of political scientists that rates congressmen and senators ideologically. And according to their calculations this week, the median Republican House member today is as conservative as at any other point in American history, which I think really gets it. I mean, and what does that mean in practice? Well, the budget balancing amendment, the constitutional amendment that the Republicans saw as their nostrum, that would effectively return federal spending to the fraction of the economy it was in 1966, before really Medicare and Medicaid came onto the budget. And that would be a drastic change in almost everything in government, and that I think is an example of what that conservatism in action means.
Mm-hmm. Ben Smith, do you agree with that? Do you think that what is really driving this now? I mean, you've been writing, I've been following you, and I'm a big fan. And basically, the consensus seems to be amongst observers like yourself that the Republicans have won in terms of where they've put the debate on austerity. Jack just mentioned going back to a different kind of government, pre-Medicare. But at the same time, they don't seem to be able to move forward.
No, I think that's about right. I mean, I think, you know, it's a difference between kind of a revolutionary spirit, whereas you say they really want to change the nature of American government, and conservatives like Boehner who think they have a opportunity to, you know, hack away at the existing American government, not to abolish Medicare or Social Security, but to scale them back, you know, and not to scale them back radically. But, you know, I mean, you take what you can get when you control one, you know, one of the three power centers. And but you know, so a lot of these folks who were elected in 2010 see themselves as on this really both as on a mission to radically change American government, and also know that they'll be vulnerable to primary challenges if they, I mean, at a much more mundane level, if they vote for raising the debt limit, which is something that sounds like raising your credit card limit and that voters don't like. I think also, you know, a wave election brings in a few, typically brings in a dozen or a couple dozen members who are just not getting reelected again. I mean, and some of these folks have huge problems for various reasons in their home districts. They're probably more conservative than would typically be elected in that district, and a lot of them are going to lose in 2 years, no matter what they do.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week in the news and what a week it's been. We're joined this hour by Ben Smith of Politico, Margaret Tolliv of Bloomberg, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. And we are expecting to hear very, very shortly from the President of the United States. And meanwhile, there has not yet been a vote in Congress on the compromise put forward by Speaker of the House John Boehner. Let's go to your calls right now. Carl, you are on the line from Nashville. Welcome to the show, Carl.
Thank you. These freshman Republicans in the House of Representatives, they remind me of a story that happened between me and my father when I was 10 years old. Years ago in Chicago, my father worked at the Rosemont Horizon. And I, at that time, at around 10, before then, I thought that wrestling was real. And he sat me down and explained to me those guys had beards and they were friends with each other. They weren't each other's mortal enemy, as I thought as a child. The freshman Republicans believe in wrestling. They don't understand that those other guys on the other aisle with the D next to their name aren't really their mortal enemy. They're only that's only the pro wrestling aspect of government. They understand politics, but they don't understand governing, and that's a frightening thing for the country. I believe the president should invoke the 14th Amendment and stand up as a leader and be judged as a guy who stood up in the face of impeachment and in the face of lawsuits as the leader that kept America's financial and the world's financial situation from going over a cliff. Those guys in the House of Representatives, the freshman Republicans, they must be able to understand fake wrestling and governing. Have a good one.
Thank you, Carl. Oh, that was great. Well, what about the 14th Amendment? What are you hearing from your sources on that, folks?
I mean, I mean, I would just say that in response to Carl, I mean, this is just not the hill the White House wants to die on. I mean, there may or may not be a legal case to be made that the president can unilaterally raise the debt, or he basically can ignore the debt ceiling. But he just, I don't think he wants, you know, Congress voted to spend this money, and I don't think he wants to be the one to take the hit for, you know, he stood up to Congress to spend more money. That it's just not a political climate in which he sort of sees any upside in that.
He's been urged to do it, though, even by the House Minority Whip, Steny Hoyer, just a couple of days ago. What do you hear, Margaret?
Well, Jackie, the White House has effectively ruled this out now. They said they just don't. They think it's. They're not sure. They don't think they have the legal authority to do it. They don't think they need to do it. And I think between the time when you get to the real 14th Amendment crisis point question and now, are still several other steps that we haven't gone through yet. Even though this seems like the tensions are so high pitched, you know, there are still a lot of Democrats in the House of Representatives and still a lot of Republicans in the House of Representatives who are not willing to go over the cliff on this.
Mm-hmm.
And between August, there is some time period between August 2nd and the time period where the U.S. really can't pay its bills. The U.S. can no longer lose its borrowing authority, is what the White House has said and the Treasury Secretary has said, after August the 2nd. But they have been very careful publicly not to say, well, on what day can't you cut the checks anymore? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they've also said that they will not default. The U.S. will not default. So what does that mean? The U.S., if the U.S. is paying, is repaying creditors, then the U.S. is not defaulting. Mm-hmm. People, government workers may get furloughed. You could be late on your benefits check, in theory. There is a lot in play between midnight August 2nd and default.
Well, I think that's a good point. It doesn't necessarily affect the bond market if some of those bills keep getting paid, although I know that that's where a lot of attention is going to be. And also, right now, we're looking at a pretty intransigent group, and that makes perhaps the whole thing seem, well, it is dire, of course, but makes it seem painted in even more purple shades. And yet, there really isn't any precedent for this to speak of. So when you hear members of the Senate, as Senator from Colorado, Mr. Bennett, said this morning, I don't know what's going to happen, I think that bespeaks a certain sense in Washington that they mean it when they say that.
I think, Judd Gregg, and I think, you know, people do think they mean it. Judd Gregg, the former senator from New Hampshire, said the other day that he thinks that the House can't move until there's a real crisis. So until the market plummets, which it has not done, although it's, you know, it's been weak, or until Social Security checks stop going out, until there's a sense of absolute crisis, that it's hard to see people moving.
Let's take another call. Bill is calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Bill.
Thank you for taking the call. This is a mess. This is a crisis that has to be laid at the feet of the American voter. In the last election, two things were going on. You had people that were saying, oh, divided government is good. Well, now we have divided government. They also wanted to throw away their vote because they wanted to make their, you know, a protest vote. Well, they threw away their vote. You have a whole bunch of nutcases in Congress right now that are making the biggest mess you've ever seen in your entire life. We have no one to blame on this situation but ourselves. It doesn't lay with Washington. It lays with us.
All right. Well, thank you for that observation, Bill. Let's get in one more call. Hank is calling from Morrisville, Vermont. Welcome to On Point,
yes,
Hank.
Thanks for taking my call. I am a small business owner. I've seen my taxes go way up, and I am sad to say that I am sick of the corporations getting all these breaks, moving to Dubai tax-free like Halliburton, paying no more taxes in this country, and who's going to take the brunt of it? The small businesses and the little guy. And they just need to get their heads off together and just do it, you know, just make it happen, because we need to see some higher-end people paying more taxes because they have so many tax breaks and tax shelters that it's disgusting.
Okay,
thank you for taking my call.
Okay, thank you. What do you think at this point a potential deal could look like, any of you? Would it be a hybridization of what the Boehner proposal is, which has already been declared dead on arrival by the Senate? Or are there some shifts in Senator Reid's bill that maybe we could expect? Does he need to make it any more palatable? And how would that look?
Well, this Jack, I mean, I think, you know, to the degree that he makes it palatable to Republicans, which I guess would be increasing its cuts, he weakens it with Democrats because they want what the president has been pushing, a balanced approach. Reid gives that up. Admittedly, there's only about $1 trillion of, quote, real cuts in there, as the Republicans have been complaining. The other cuts are, you know, phasing out of the wars and so on. It seems to me that the scenario of breakdown is more likely, if I were to bet, than that of passage. I mean, you can imagine the Democrats holding out to the last, sending their bill, the Reid bill, to the, if they can even get it through the Senate, sending it to the House, and the House turning it down because 23 Republicans wouldn't vote for it, and there might have been some Democratic defections.
That's the 14th Amendment scenario, I think, the late night scenario where mm-hmm. the president is simply where the Congress won't act, and the debt of the country is going to be impaired. And then the question is, what does the president do?
Well, and there's still time to do that, because Senator Reid has basically said, I need your bill by the end of today. Let's say he gets it. Senate votes it down. They still have all day Monday to basically not hear anything again. And, you know, Ben, you said, and Margaret, you both said that the White House, and I know they have said that the 14th Amendment is not an option, but if there's not a deal by midnight Monday, you know, 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday, how is that different from where we are on this Friday morning?
Well, if there's not a deal by that deadline, they do always have the option of doing kind of an emergency short-term extension of a couple of days. And House Republican leadership seems to be less concerned that they'd have the ability to do that than get this resolution of, is it going to be 6 months or is it going to be 18 months for the extension? It seems like all this tension, right? But you could kind of take a breather for a couple of days, most likely.
And have a nice weekend.
Well, no one's having a nice weekend. We can absolutely rule that out right now. It's over before it started. But it is – the question after midnight August 2nd likely turns to the ratings question, which is, even if you do, you know, 2 or 3 day extension –
the credit ratings question
on whether the United States credit rating will be downgraded.
Right, from AAA.
That's right, over the long term. Because if, let's say they think they're in position to get something, maybe not on August 2nd, maybe on August 3rd or August 4th, and so everybody agrees, okay, well, we're all working in good faith, let's do a short-term extension. It still may signal to credit ratings agencies that, you know, that this has hit sort of a new threshold of intractability. Nobody really knows, and there's a lot of speculation, but not a lot of hard evidence one way or the other. Everybody's concerned about it. The White House is concerned about it. Both political parties in both chambers are concerned about it. And there may be indeed a solid block of House Republicans who feel so strongly about the debt ceiling that they're willing to take it to this point. But there needs to be said, there are many Republicans in the House of Representatives and in the Senate who don't take the same tack, who are uncomfortable about the way things have gone, and who are, you know, are pro-business Republicans, and business likes certainty in markets, and this makes them uncomfortable. And so it looks like everybody's, you know, buckled down for a showdown now, but the closer you get to August 2nd, you'll see some realignments. And what's going on, what House leadership is telling the members who don't want to budge is, look, the longer you hold out, the more bargaining power you give Harry Reid, because the greater the chances that enough Senate Republicans will get really uncomfortable with how far this has gone and be forced to make a decision. And if they fall in with the Senate Democrats, this thing goes back to the House, mm-hmm. and you've given up our power to bargain.
Yeah. I read in a blog post last night from the Washington Post from a Republican congressman, an aide, who I think is in the camp that you talked about, who did want to vote for the Boehner bill. There are buckets of crazy going on around here. Let's take another call. Ellen is calling from Middlebury, Vermont. Hello, Ellen.
Hi, Jackie. My question is this. I know that it's a, you know, given that we know that there's the Republicans seem to be fanatically devoted to no taxes for the wealthy and corporations, or, you know, really lowering them and dismantling the social safety net and government spending, which actually might stimulate the economy. Don't your panelists think that Obama made a real strategic decision to get us that to this point? And that is, last December, he let the Bush tax cuts, you know, he should have let the Bush tax cuts expire. And then he could have gone back to this, you know, anti-tax Congress in January and said, now we need to reinstitute the middle-class tax cut.
Actually,
and then he would have been in the driver's seat.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, instead, now he's become hostage to this extreme right-wing agenda, which, you know, if they get even what Obama proposed, which was three-quarters of what they wanted, even though, you know, they walked away from it, it will have, you know, very negative effects on the economy. And I do want to point out that at least our senator in Vermont, Bernie Sanders, understood all this back in December, which is why he filibustered for 8 hours to, you know, on this issue of letting the Bush tax cuts expire.
Let me talk to our reporters about that. My understanding, Margaret and Ben and Jack, is that the Bush tax cuts are not set to expire until the end of December 2012.
Right, and that's going to create basically the reverse of the scenario in which Democrats can say, we can just sit on our hands and do nothing and the taxes are going to go up. And the sort of leverage will be reversed. But there's certainly a question of whether Republicans would agree to a budget that anticipated that. Although no matter what they agree to now, there is an infinite number of fights down the road over revising that agreement.
Do you think, Jack, that the president, what do you see as his culpability here? Is he culpable?
Oh, gosh. I have to say I favored the deal he made in December. I thought it was the best deal he could make. And crucial to it was that there was a renewal of unemployment insurance in it. And just thinking of, you know, the millions of people who'd be without it, I mean, the moral case for it seemed overwhelming. Second, there was an economic case for it. Wasteful as tax cuts for upper income people are, generally, they do have some stimulative effect. And so the December decision, I think, was quite consistent with the president's with what should be the president's position, which is he wants unemployment down, he wants the economy stimulated. So I don't see that necessarily as such a bad move. I mean, what Senator Sanders wanted to do, the Republicans essentially could have prevented millions of people from receiving unemployment checks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The next move, then, do you think that the president has some capital to spend here, Margaret, if he exhorts the Congress yet again? He did that Monday night, and it didn't really move things very much. Is he basically going to be able to do that today?
Well, the president's doing two things. He's trying to govern the country, and he's trying to run for re-election. And so when you parse his speeches, you know, they exist on two levels. And talking to lawmakers in both parties this week, it's sort of a predictable mix of, on the one hand, when you order Republicans down to talk to you and you blame Congress, you sort of dampen their enthusiasm for negotiating. But on the other hand, if they're not interested in negotiating anyway, what does it really cost you, right? The president right now is trying to stay involved in this process. And because the talks between he and House Speaker Boehner fell apart, the White House has been sort of two steps back this whole week.
Well, we haven't really seen him this week, mostly sending out the lieutenants talking.
That's right. Forced to watch Congress to negotiate or to negotiate through the Vice President, Joe Biden, who, of course, was the senator for a long time and has those relationships on Capitol Hill. You know, in April, the president finally comes out with a plan for how he wants to tackle the deficit reduction, insists that the debt ceiling fight not be connected to it, and, you know, within the span of 2 months is arguing almost the opposite point, which is that everything should be connected, largest deal possible. So,
all right. Well, stay with us. We're discussing the debt ceiling standoff, and the president is about to speak. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. You're listening to On Point. This is Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and we go now live to President Obama, who's speaking about the debt ceiling negotiations.
Terrorist attacks. This isn't one of those crises. The power to solve this is in our hands. And on a day when we've been reminded how fragile the economy already is, this is one burden we can lift ourselves. We can end it with a simple vote, a vote that Democrats and Republicans have been taking for decades. A vote that the leaders in Congress have taken for decades. It's not a vote that allows Congress to spend more money. Raising the debt ceiling simply gives our country the ability to pay the bills that Congress has already racked up. I want to emphasize that. The debt ceiling does not determine how much more money we can spend. It simply authorizes us to pay the bills we already have racked up. It gives the United States of America the ability to keep its word. Now, on Monday night, I asked the American people to make their voice heard in this debate, and the response was overwhelming. So please, to all the American people, keep it up. If you want to see a bipartisan compromise, a bill that can pass both houses of Congress and that I can sign, let your members of Congress know. Make a phone call, send an email, tweet. Keep the pressure on Washington, and we can get past this. And for my part, our administration will be continuing to work with Democrats and Republicans all weekend long until we find a solution. The time for putting party first is over. The time for compromise on behalf of the American people is now. And I'm confident that we can solve this problem. I'm confident that we will solve this problem. For all the intrigue and all the drama that's taking place on Capitol Hill right now, I'm confident. But as I said earlier, we are now running out of time. It's important for everybody to step up and show the leadership that the American people expect. Thank you.
Do you have more talks here, sir?
And the president will be answering some further questions from the press. Our guests on the weekly news roundtable are Ben Smith, senior political writer at Politico, Margaret Tallev of Bloomberg, and our own Jack Beattie. Well, the president called for bipartisanship. He said that this is a problem we can solve. It's not like a terrorist attack. The means, the way out are in our own hands. He was speaking very presidentially. He said that the Boehner plan is a waste of time. They should vote on it and also encourage the American people to let their representatives know. A short and pithy presentation. Margaret, we were thinking that this is pretty much what he was going to do. And since we did know that, I mean, what effect will it have practically?
In the short term, everyone who's staffing a desk in a congressman or congresswoman's office right now is probably going to be girding for the switchboards to go off again. But, you know, what the president is doing is continuing to focus the problem on Congress, to say Congress are the ones who are stalling on this. I am not the one who is stalling on this. He's at the same time trying to calm investors and calm the public. He's saying on the one hand, we're running out of time, and on the other hand, we still have time. And he's urging people to keep up the pressure. The time for putting party first is over. When he talks that way, he is presenting himself as a voice of bipartisanship, even as he is picking on the Republican plan and saying it's dead, it's a waste of time, there's no point. He is at the same time presenting himself as a voice of bipartisanship while he's being partisan.
And the president, well, I was just going to say, Ben, he says this is not a situation where the two parties are miles apart.
No, it's also worth noting that there wasn't, you know, there was not a shred of policy in that speech. He did not say we need to protect this for program for our seniors or we need to spend more. He didn't make an ideological case for a Democratic program. He was sort of back to the Obama of his campaign, which was bring people together, compromise is good for basically for its own sake, and that what the American people here should call and should call and demand is bipartisan compromise, not compromise on any particular terms. You know, which is something that I think sometimes infuriates people on both sides of this debate. And I think it remains to be seen whether that's a sort of effective strategy.
Well, in fact, he said in the coming months we can talk about things. You're right, he didn't mention specifics. It made it sound like more compromise, perhaps looking at entitlements is definitely possible. Let's take another call. Mandy is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Welcome to On Point, Mandy.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. I had just 2 points that I wanted to bring up. I'm a military spouse, and I don't feel that our elected officials are doing their job. And I feel really helpless, I guess, and many of the people that I talk to feel helpless about this whole situation. My husband, as I said, is an officer in the military, and I hate to imagine what would happen if there was a leadership crisis on this scale in the military. And it's the job of our lawmakers to find a compromise, and they're not doing that. And I find the politics of this situation to be infuriating, not to mention embarrassing. And it doesn't seem, one of the reasons I feel hopeless, I guess, is because it doesn't seem that there is any accountability for them or any consequences for them personally in terms of doing a bad job. And then the other point that I wanted to make is that I think it's especially surprising since this particular issue, in my opinion, hits the average American much harder, since I think the war has had very little effect on the average person in our country, just meaning that their life has not been directly impacted by what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya, things like that.
Have you thought about what it will mean? Well, the president says that we simply can't have a default, and so let's operate from the standpoint that there will not be one. But have you thought about what it will mean for your family if your husband doesn't get paid?
Absolutely. And I'm sure we're one of those people that have slowed down the, what is it, 0.4% of consumer growth in the last quarter. And we're certainly making different spending choices. And, you know, we went through this when there was the government shutdown.
Mm-hmm.
Because my husband and all of the military families we know were under the threat of not getting being paid eventually, but not getting paid when their paycheck was due. And of course, my husband's an officer in the military, but the enlisted folks are much more heavily dependent on that first and 15th paycheck. You know, you go to the commissary and you see huge lines on the second because everyone's been paid on the first. So that will have an absolutely huge impact on our enlisted families.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mandy. Let's take another call. Deborah is calling from Stannardsville, Virginia. Hello, Deborah. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. The point I want to make is that I feel the House Republicans are extremist in their position. Shrinking our federal spending to pre-Medicare, pre-Medicaid levels, the 1960s, which you mentioned earlier, would really devastate the economy and hurt people. And I wonder if the Republicans have parents. Do they know any poor people? They appear to be making no effort to close tax loopholes, reduce business subsidies, adjust taxes for the wealthy. I'm not sure if the debt crisis is fabricated, as Paul Krugman says, and I don't mean the ceiling, but I mean the debt-to-revenue ratio. But I do know that the tactics the Republicans are using will hurt our already sluggish economy and hurt real people's lives.
Well, what do you think? Thank you very much for that point, Deborah. Margaret, I was, again, because you're in Washington, what are you hearing? Have you been at any of the sort of, you know, impromptu conferences that some of the holdouts have had? I have colleagues and friends and, in fact, a spouse who is a photographer for The Washington Post who's been watching some of these folks. And, you know, they have said everything from, you know, I'm bloodied, but unbowed. I'm going to pray over this. What sorts of remarks are you hearing?
Yeah, I've been primarily over at the White House as this has unfolded, and so most of the sort of emotion and color I'm seeing from
just
you know,
look
the halls
down Massachusetts
and,
Avenue a little bit.
That's all right. I just look over my is through my colleagues because I have, you know, mm-hmm. a dozen colleagues at least who are over there and we're sending emails at all times, and these anecdotes are coming in at real time, and it's absolutely these. Especially the freshmen, because this is a new experience for them. Many of the freshman House Republicans, they are really stressed out about this because there is a lot of energy, a lot of emotion, a lot of urgency, and a lot at stake for themselves, for their party, for their constituents. And constituencies are complicated, even in really solid red or blue districts. Constituencies are a mix of individuals who don't have a lot of personal wealth, of business leaders, of small business versus corporate leaders, of, you know, a lot of people who, even if they all generally believe in holding the line on spending, believe in it to different degrees and on different levels. And do you stand by a balanced budget amendment or is that a gimmick? I mean, these are like, the calculus of this is really complicated. And these, particularly the newer members, are trying to balance what their gut is telling them against what their leadership is telling them against the constituent calls that they're getting. And it is a pressure cooker over there.
Hmm.
And I think, like all politicians, they also all have an eye to their reelection campaigns and, you know, and to the threat of, you know, primarily to the threat of a Tea Party Republican primary. Sarah Palin, you know, emailed out yesterday, wrote on her Facebook page that she believes in contested primaries as sort of a hint, you know, that they should, basically a threat that people who vote for to raise the debt ceiling could face those primaries. And you know, I think they saw what happened in 2010 with this real wave of kind of grassroots conservative activism, and they'd like to keep their jobs.
And yet, it's so interesting, isn't it, Jack? Because we're not talking about a plan that they would view perhaps as radical from the other side, with injecting the kinds of things the Obama administration has been talking about for their slogan, "Win the Future," spend more money, create jobs, hire people to repair the infrastructure, things the president has said he wants to do, those kinds of things. Basically, this battle is being fought very much on the turf of austerity. So it's hard to see how much further people who don't agree with the hardliners could possibly go.
Well, indeed, including the president. According to Nate Silver of the New York Times, who does these algebraic ruminations about politics, the president's position last week, bargaining with Speaker Boehner, was to the right, slightly to the right of the average Republican voter's preferences, that is, on entitlements especially. Think of that. This is a president who was to the right of the average Republican voter, and it wasn't enough for the Congress. Speaker Boehner, was probably enough for him, more than enough. He could have gone and said, "I've got a $4 trillion deal." He wouldn't have got the votes from his caucus, which just tells us everything, I think, about the Republicans, but also about Mr. Obama. I mean, we just heard him say Washington is the problem. Really, that was the rhetoric, you know, it's been said from the campaign. Well, you know, Paul Krugman, I think, makes a very nonpartisan, but I think I think accurate point today. It isn't Washington that is the problem here. It is a faction in the modern Republican Party that is the problem. That's what's making the system dysfunctional right now. The president was bent over backwards to make he was to the right of the average Republican to make a deal, and it wasn't good enough for these people. As you know, they wouldn't take yes for an answer. Why? Because I think their overriding priority is to defeat him and deny him the powers to make his government work,
even if it takes the rest of the country down with it. Let's take another call. Emmerich is calling from Davenport, Iowa. Welcome to On Point, Emmerich.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for taking the call. I'd like to make 3 points, if I may.
Well, let me just say quickly, we have less than 4 minutes, so very quickly.
Less than 2 minutes.
Okay.
Politically, I am a independent. I see the issue first being ideological. What is the role of the government? I think this election last November stated that there was some concern the direction ideologically the country was going.
And what is your point here, Emmerich?
The second is we cannot borrow our way out of debt. And the third is, instead of finger-pointing at Republicans or Democrats or radicals or this, that, or the other thing, I think we need to, as a government, take it back to responsible spending. If you're going to increase the debt, make sure you decrease the spending legitimately, not just shadow spending.
Will you be calling your congressman and saying that?
I have already done that. I called the congressman and I wrote the president yesterday morning.
Okay. Thank you very much for making your points, Emmerich. But, of course, we are talking about money that has already been spent, and we are talking about raising the ceiling to pay bills that are already coming due. So to some degree, that is a philosophical debate that it would have to take place after this mess is sorted out, correct?
I mean, typically the budget is shaped during, you know, budget talks and budget votes, and this is sort of a second bite at that particular apple. I did want to differ with something Jack said earlier, which is that these folks really just want to stop the president. While it is true a lot of them hate Obama and want to stop him, the notion that this is a brilliant political strategy for the Republicans or even any kind of political strategy, I think I don't really think that's the case. I mean, I think they really are snatching political defeat and possibly policy defeat from the jaws of victory right now.
In other words, you think that and polls have shown that when the
I think, you know, it gives
we'll hold them accountable.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll give Obama an opportunity to run against a sort of out of control Congress that's very unpopular, and to say and to ask of a Republican presidential candidate like Mitt Romney, you know, can this guy control those people?
Well, yeah, good point, Margaret.
And I'm just going to throw this out there because it's obviously
fast,
a whole other
fast.
Conversation. But yes, but even if it's Harry Reid's plan, the larger plan, $2.5 trillion in cuts over 10 years, you're looking at about a $2.5 trillion debt ceiling extension. And we're talking there about 18 months to 24 months, right, versus 10 years. So this is going to be relitigated, whether it's 18 months from now or whether it's 6 months from now. The problem is not going away. And depending on the makeup of future Congresses and how this situation resolves itself, maybe a roadmap for whether this continues to be a fight that's had instead of a vote that's automatic.
Yeah. I can't wait to see the history books on this one. Well, I want to thank everybody for their participation today. It was really a lively morning, a historic morning. And Ben Smith with Politico, Margaret Tolliv with Bloomberg, Jack Beatty joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Thank you, everybody, very much for being here. And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website on onpointradio.org and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.